Hey everyone, welcome to Trashy Divorces. My name is Stacy.
Hey friends, I'm Alicia. Thanks for joining us today as we continue our journey through season 14. It don't come easy. That's the theme of our episode today with the popular 1971 hit from Ringo Starr's solo career.
Who is?
The focus of my profile today.
Indeed.
Last of the Fab Four that we have not covered.
Yes.
Nothing was
easy. The final 25%. We've now achieved 100% of Beatles.
Huzzah! This week, you're bringing us a different kind of It Don't Come Easy, Stacey.
Yeah, this is Marvel's Hawkeye. Jeremy Renner has had a very, very, very ugly post-divorce period with his ex-wife of 10 months. That's Jeremy Renner. Did I say that?
Yeah, nothing coming easy today. Before we start our episode, I do have a magic mirror that's sliding out very easily with some very special names of our newest supporters on Patreon in it. Let's give some big thanks and praise and shout outs.
Yes, thank you so much for joining us at patreon.com/trashydivorces. Ellen H, Darcy V, Amanda W, Kristen S, Tori M, and Alicia P.
Holy cats, we have two new super supporters this week. Kim R and Amanda F, amazing. Thank you, thank you, thank you. All of our Patreon supporters getting early ad-free content, bonus episodes. We can't tell you how much we appreciate your support.
Definitely.
And to you for coming to tune in today.
Yep.
Stacey, if we're not going to make it any harder, what should we do?
We'd better go, go, go. Oh, Alicia, this one's been a long time coming, right? Because we've covered 3 of 4.
We have. We are here today for the last of the Fab Four.
The last 25%.
I've got the Trashy Divorces of Ringo Starr today.
History's greatest drummer.
He's a talented drummer.
Sure.
Remembered as one of the good ones in history, but the story is really quite a ride. It's very nice, then it's very, very trashy. But there is a little bit of a redemption arc at the end.
We do love those.
It don't come easy.
Okay.
This is the fourth of the Beatles that we're going to cover in our Trashy Divorces purview. Let's talk about Ringo Starr, who was born Richard Starkey on July 7th, 1940, in Liverpool, England. Not the greatest of childhoods. Richard's father leaves him and his mother when he's about 4 years old. Mom supports she and Richard with multiple jobs, cleaning houses, waitressing, kind of tough. Poor Richard is nearly going to die when he's 6 because he contracts peritonitis after he has his appendix removed.
Yikes.
And he's so sick that he's in the hospital, not for a week, not for a month, but for an entire year.
Wow.
Before he recovers.
In the 40s, too, that must have been miserable.
Obviously, causes a little bit of a delay for our young Richard. He requires a lot of extra help to catch him back up in school. I mean, if you're out of school for a year.
Yeah.
Just as the kid is getting back on track, he's diagnosed with tuberculosis.
Good Lord.
Richard then spends 2 years in a sanatorium. Now, I know that seems really bad.
It does. It really does.
I'm not saying any of it was good. It was very, very bad. But the unlucky illnesses in his childhood is likely one of the reasons that he becomes a famous member of the Beatles and a drummer. During his time at the sanatorium, the staff will try to distract all the patients by having them form a band.
Hey.
So it is in this sanatorium band that Richard first plays the drums that aren't really drums. They give him a wooden mallet and just let him beat it against the cabinets next to his bed.
Wow.
But no matter, Richard develops a love of percussion. Let me beat shit and make loud noises.
I mean, at that point, that has to be the most therapeutic thing in the world.
Well, Ringo isn't Ringo yet. He's still Richard. Doesn't return to school, but instead begins apprenticing at a few different jobs and will continue to work on music. I think school has sort of left him behind.
I think, yeah, you missed 3 years in a staggered way. That's tough.
No worries. Richard's going to join a band in 1959 called Rory Storm and the Hurricanes.
Good name.
Good name. Rory Storm and the Hurricanes. Richard joins as their drummer, and this is the time that he decides that the name Richard Starkey isn't quite catchy enough for a drummer, so he will adopt his stage name of Ringo Starr.
It is an improvement, I have to say.
Now, John and Paul, Lennon and McCartney, had already formed their band back in Liverpool in 1957. Paul's the bassist, John is the singer. They have a guitarist, George Harrison, he plays lead, and a musician named Stuart Sutcliffe will join the band and take over as the band's lead bass guitarist. In 1959, these guys cohesed together and become known as the Beatles. But it doesn't take too long. Summer 1960, Sutcliffe's out. He's going to leave the Beatles because he wants to go to art school.
What a life choice.
It's bad, isn't going to work out. Who's ever heard of a future in music? So a drummer named Pete Best will join the band. Now, the band, gaining popularity, this is the point where they take on Brian Epstein as their manager, getting us up to 1962 when Pete Best is fired from the Beatles, which causes an uproar with their fans. People are mad, especially at one of the places they play most often, the Cavern Club. There are a few different theories about why Pete Best is replaced in the band, but some evidence points to the reason that Best was the best-looking member of the band, and some of the other members of the band didn't quite like that.
Okay, but he was properly labeled.
There's a particular incident in Manchester which supports this particular "you're too good-looking" theory. Mm-hmm. Pete was accidentally cut by a wild fan wielding scissors trying to cut off a piece of his shirt for a souvenir.
Oh, boy.
So, naturally scared, the band returned to the tour bus, and Pete was immediately lectured for showing up the boys.
Can you imagine approaching your favorite band with, like, a knife?
I want to cut your clothes? That's not weird at all.
No way that is good planning.
Got some jagged little scissors here.
For real.
Okay. All right. So it is just 2 months later that Ringo will replace Pete. Now, a lot of other people just attribute the decision to fire Pete Best because he was a lousy drummer. Hmm. He's just kind of a mediocre drummer. He may be good looking, but his skills aren't that extraordinary. I'm going to let Beatles fans out there decide what you want to believe. That is not my pond to throw a rock into. In a biography of Pete Best, though, author Spencer Lee writes, "Unfortunately, in circumstances still clouded in mystery, Pete Best was dismissed from the group he had played with for over 2 years. The real reason was never given to Pete. The rest is legend." Whatever the real reason, it is fortunate for our Ringo Starr, who will join the Beatles as their drummer in August of 1962. That first performance, though, was really rough, right? So they're at the Cavern Club, and all the loyal fans of Pete Best are heckling, yelling, throwing fruit. I'm just kidding. They weren't really throwing fruit.
You don't know.
Paul tries to do some crowd control.
Sure.
But he's unsuccessful in calming the upset fans. Now a few fans are starting to threaten Ringo. It's a terrible first night.
This is like honky-tonk stuff, you know, where you have to put like chain link in front of the stage. Beer bottles don't come
through. His friend George Harrison, right? Mm-hmm. George is like, "I'm going to stick up for you." And there's this one guy who's much bigger. And George Harrison gets involved. And for his effort, he gets a black eye.
Wow.
Protecting his friend Ringo Starr.
Amazing. Wow. Like British clubgoers in the Cavern Club. 60s were not
Intense.
Playing around.
So although the transition was certainly not smooth at first, fans eventually come around and see that Ringo's a pretty good drummer, and he'll be accepted as a member of the beloved band. That's Ringo's backstory.
Liverpudlians, calm down.
Let's meet Ringo's first wife, Mary Cox. She's born on August 4th in 1946, also in Liverpool. Mary is an only child who leaves school at 14 to become a hairdresser and will change her name to Maureen at the same time. Friends call her Mo. Maureen loves music. Hanging out in clubs, where all the live music is getting played. One of her favorite clubs is the cavern. And it was there that she sees the coolest new band in Liverpool playing. Maureen's a regular at the Cavern Club, and she'll remember the long lines to get in, as well as all of the aggressive behavior, barroom brawls from the fans. She'll say, "I never joined the queue until about 2 or 3 hours before it opened because it frightened me. There were fights and rows amongst the girls, and when the doors opened, the first ones would tear in, knocking each other over." But alas, Maureen is a young girl in Liverpool, so like every other Cavern Club patron, Mo quickly becomes a huge fan of the Beatles. Mo even once kisses Paul McCartney for a bet, but he's not the one that she had her eye on. Mo naturally thinks all of the four band members are pretty cute, but it is the drummer, mm-hmm. Ringo Starr, that Mo really mm-hmm. likes. And one day she decides to ask him for his autograph. Ringo Starr will later admit he has no recollection of their first meeting. But 3 weeks after that, asking him for an autograph, Ringo notices her at a different show at the Cavern. And within just a few weeks, the two are dating. It's 1963. Maureen is 16 years old.
Okay.
Now, the Beatles in 1963 had not yet become famous. But as their popularity grew and they become more widely known, Maureen becomes an object of hatred from their fans.
This is so weird. All right.
Maureen is threatened by female fans. She's even attacked. Ironically, now you ready for the flip side of this?
Do tell.
Maureen is the one that's answering all the fan mail that gets sent to Ringo. So she's writing letters back to all these girls who hate her guts.
Oh my God.
Thanks, Sally, for your letter. Love, Ringo.
16, 17. Mm-hmm. Oh my God. Poor woman.
In 1964, the pressures of the increasingly famous band schedule and popularity will cause Ringo and Mo to break up. In June 1964, the day before leaving for their international tour, Ringo collapses during a photo session for the Saturday Evening Post. At the hospital, it's determined he had a 102-degree fever
Yikes.
And tonsillitis. He's sick.
Mm-hmm.
"Ringo, how can we help you?" He says, "I need Maureen by my side." Mo will visit the hospital every day and help Ringo recuperate, bringing him ice cream. And by the time he recovers, the two off-again lovers are now back on again. In January of 1965, Maureen learns that she's pregnant, and the couple decide to get married the following month. Ringo is advised not to get married by everyone who knows him.
Sure.
Because they thought it would put a damper on his fame as a teen idol.
Mm-hmm.
Ringo doesn't care. It is February 11th, 1965, when Ringo and Maureen are married at the Caxton Hall Registry office. The Beatles manager, Brian Epstein, will serve as best man and host a reception for them at his home. Hearts break across the world. There's even a band, Angie and the Chiclets, record a song, "Treat Him Tender, Maureen."
Oh my God.
In honor of their marriage.
Much pressure? Okay.
Tony Barrow is the Beatles' press officer, and he will describe Maureen this way. "She was the least worldly of the Beatles' women folk in the 60s. She was less glamorous than McCartney's girlfriend, Jane Asher, less famous than Harrison's wife, Patty Boyd, and not nearly as smart as Cynthia Lennon. But she was chirpy, with an irreverent sense of humor, and she suited Ringo right down to the ground."
Oh, that's cool.
Isn't that such a nice thing?
Yeah.
On September 13th, 1965, the couple will welcome their first child, Zach Starkey. On the same day, the single Yesterday was published. Ringo and Mo go on to have two more children during their marriage, Jason in 1967 and Lee in 1970. There's a friend of Maureen's, Chris O'Dell, describes her as a character who got along with everyone. She wasn't afraid to be her own person. She dressed the way she wanted to, spoke the way she wanted to. Her loyalty was one of her deepest qualities. Journalist Maureen Cleave will describe Maureen and her relationship with Ringo this way. "She doesn't talk much, but what she does say is sensible. She adores him and calls him Richie. They always sit very close, side by side, and Ringo always lights two cigarettes simultaneously one for her and one for him. Maureen is best friends with Cynthia Lennon, at the time married to John, also enjoys a close friendship with Patty Boyd Harrison, who will marry George. Mm-hmm. These couples often go on vacation together. They spend holidays together.
I mean, where else, like, who else can they be friends with? Every woman hates them.
They're friends with each other. Maureen and Cynthia will confide in each other and go out shopping. They, you know, they have a good friendship. Early in the marriage, Ringo promises Maureen that he would take his fame and money and set up for his beautiful wife a national salon business for her so she could do hair and oversee other hairstylists across the country. But kids come along.
Sure.
The Beatles, kind of a popular, famous band.
I've heard of them.
Busier than ever.
Sure. A little bit of travel.
This plan eventually gets shelved. So instead, Maureen, in addition to taking care of kids, she will continue being extremely active in the Beatles fan club, answering many fan letters, even until the band breaks up. And although Maureen really does enjoy raising their children and occasionally going out on the road with the band, she does miss having a career of her own. As it does, the novelty of the wealth and the fame will wear off, and Maureen will spend evenings waiting with the other Beatle wives and girlfriends at clubs like the Speakeasy, the Ad Lib, or the Scotch of St. James. You can visualize this picture. She's staying up half the night with a home-cooked meal for Ringo, who's recording in the middle of the night after long recording sessions. She's left alone with the kids while the Beatles are performing.
Yeah, I feel like we tell a version of this story quite a bit on this show.
Easy to see how she feels lonely and a little bit neglected.
Overwhelmed.
For her birthday in 1968, here's a fun spiderweb, Frank Sinatra will playfully rework the song The Lady is a Tramp for Maureen. The new lyrics he sang to her included, "She married Ringo and she could have had Paul. That's why the lady is a champ." But all is not well in the Starkey marriage. Ringo is having increasing issues with alcohol abuse. He has a string of infidelities. In 1968, Ringo becomes so fed up with his bandmates during the recording of the White Album that he quits the Beatles. He walks out of Abbey Road Studios and takes refuge on Peter Sellers' yacht. Because naturally, that's where you go when you want to hide out, the yacht of Peter Sellers.
That's where I would go.
It is during this brief hiatus that he will write his song, The Octopus's Garden. I love that song. Which will appear on the Beatles' Abbey Road album in 1969. Mm-hmm. Their reunion, though, is short-lived. Because by the time Maureen and Ringo's daughter Lee was born, the marriage is in major trouble.
Yeah.
It was a rough year for everyone involved. 1970 is also the year the Beatles broke up. Everything's kind of coming apart.
Gotcha.
But the Beatles, 1970, dissolve, and it's in 1971 that Ringo and Maureen will purchase John Lennon's home in Tittenhurst Park in Berkshire, where they will move their young family there. Let's get back together as a family. See if we can stitch this back together.
Yeah, kind of out in the country a bit and away from... That has to have been, like, the decade of the 60s for all members of the Beatles must have been this incredibly, like, pressure cooker and highs and lows kind of experience.
So stay in that pressure cooker.
Okay.
As the problems are just starting.
Okay.
In 1972, Maureen is going to go visit George Harrison.
Oh, no.
Who is married to Patty Boyd at the time.
Yeah.
To get, you know, a little bit of help from a friend discussing the issues that she and Ringo are having.
We all need a little help from our friends.
Well, George Harrison helped Maureen ride along in this visit, confessing his love for Maureen. George and Maureen end up having an affair.
Sure. Beatles wife swap. Okay.
Now, this is worse. Eventually, George Harrison just tells Ringo all about it.
Oh, my God.
So... Chris O'Dell, again, good friend of the Harrisons and the Stars, author of Hard Days and Long Nights with the Beatles, the Stones, Bob Dylan, and Eric Clapton, will describe how it all goes down this way. "We sat at the long wooden table in the kitchen, Ringo and George on one bench, Patty and I facing them on the opposite bench. Maureen spent the entire evening flitting around like a little bird, landing here, then there, jumping up to cook an omelet for Ringo, refilling our drinks, bringing plates of food to the table. Finally, Harrison turned to Star with no concern that his own wife was sitting right there and said, "You know, Ringo, I'm in love with your wife."
Oh my God. George.
Ringo's response? Better you than someone we don't know.
Oddly sensible.
Process that. Better you than someone we don't know. Which I guess is a... That's a response.
I guess if you're looking for the silver lining.
Well, Patty Boyd, right? A la Love Triangle with Eric Clapton.
Exactly.
Comes home a few weeks later after this, and Patty Boyd finds George in bed with Maureen. Patty goes to Ringo and says, "Hey, I found them sleeping together." Ringo will threaten Maureen with a divorce. John Lennon gets wind of this situation, and he is so mad. He will call Harrison's affair with Maureen, quote unquote, virtual incest.
Wow.
You don't sleep with your bandmates.
I mean.
Why? It's virtual incest, according to John Lennon.
Sure.
Despite extramarital affairs on both sides of the equation, Maureen is having him, Ringo's having him. Maureen doesn't want a divorce. So at the time, the couple stay together, but things do not improve. Ringo is having an affair with a model named Nancy Andrews that is very much made public. When it is made public, now Ringo and Maureen decide that it's time to split, and they officially separate in July of 1975. Ringo and Maureen will have a brief attempt at reconciliation after Ringo breaks up with Nancy Andrews. But despite that...
That's a lot of water under the bridge at that point.
Yeah. The writing's on the wall.
I think maybe the bridge is washed away by then.
Bridge is out.
Yeah.
The bridge is burned and the bridge is out. On July 17th, 1975, the divorce of Ringo Starr and Maureen is finalized on the grounds of Ringo's affair with model Nancy Lee Andrews. Ringo Starr agrees to give Maureen custody of the children, a one-time payment of £125,000, along with £23,000 a year. She's also awarded £2,500 a year for each of the children. So probably in the mid-70s?
Probably.
It's not terrible. It's going to come back, though. Ringo Starr will later admit to several wrongdoings during their marriage and express remorse for those dysfunctional behaviors. In his own words, Ringo confesses that he had been, quote, a drunk, a wife beater, and an absent father.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
It's like the trifecta.
He will continue to say how much he regrets being neglectful and unfaithful to Maureen. But despite the clear marital problems, the divorce and the actual finalization of that causes Maureen to become deeply depressed. At one point, she is so distraught that she will drive a motorcycle into a brick wall in an unsuccessful attempt at suicide.
That's really too bad.
Ringo, not much better for the wear, he will go through his own major depression shortly afterward. In 1976... Ringo will suffer a complete emotional collapse while vacationing in Monaco. He ends up completely shaving his head and eyebrows and is asking to be checked for boils constantly.
Wow.
Later, he'll admit that he had been feeling vaguely insane and drinking some new drink. It was a time when you either cut your wrists or your hair, and I'm a coward.
I feel like these are two people who could no longer be together, but clearly also being apart is really bad.
If you've been together since you're a teenager and you don't know how to be. And
That's rough.
Okay. Here's a little... Okay, it's going to get worse before it gets better.
Okay.
But in 1980, Ringo Starr will meet actress Barbara Bach on the set of a film called Caveman. Barbara Bach started modeling in the 1960s. She's featured in magazines like Elle and Vogue.
I think I saw Caveman. I think I remember Caveman being very funny. Okay.
Barbara will move on to acting. In 1977, she becomes recognizable across the world. She's a Bond girl in The Spy Who Loved Me. Bach had been previously married and divorced. She married an Italian businessman. Count Gregorini di Savignano de Romagna.
Oh, yeah.
That's probably something
that's
like that.
The name.
We're just going to call him Count Greg.
Sure.
To make it easy. Count Greg and Barbara get married in 1968.
Okay.
They divorce in 1975. So by the time of 1980, Ringo is now 40 years old. He's taking a break from music to try out a little bit of acting.
Sure.
And he finds himself cast in this film Caveman alongside the beautiful Barbara Bach, who is 33. According to them and others, it is instant attraction and the two begin a relationship right away. Just a few months into the relationship, they are convinced that they are meant for each other. Now, the couple doesn't really make any long-term plans to make their relationship official, but they are in a car accident together. And when this happens, they both realize they don't want to wait another day. They each have minor injuries, but just a few weeks after this car accident, they decide to marry. But alas, marriage does not fix the problems that Ringo is having with his depression or addiction issues. He finds himself with a great deal of time on his hands. He's depressed, he's bored, and he has an almost endless supply of money at his disposal.
I bet this will go well.
Well, it leads to major alcoholism and drug abuse. He begins spending a lot of time around some notorious partiers in the scene. One of those Keith Richards.
Mm, yeah, that guy.
Well, the aftermath of the unprecedented success of Beatlemania, along with his disappointing solo career, sets Ringo on a downward spiral and he becomes very self-destructive. By the mid-1980s, Ringo is downing a bottle of champagne for breakfast. This is the extent that his alcoholism reaches. He refuses to drive anywhere that's more than 40 minutes away because that's as long as he could be without a drink.
Wow. Okay.
My limit is 40 minutes.
Well, it implies, though, that he pre-games and then hits the road as well, which all of which is bad.
Dangerous. Now, while Barbara Bach may have been Ringo's soulmate and they felt it made for each other mm-hmm. together, she was also a heavy drinker and drug user. Barbara's daughter from her first marriage said she liked going to boarding school because it allowed her to escape the drugs' heyday. She went on to say that their trouble made me a better academic. I was always hidden away in a room reading because mom and dad were out of it.
Wow.
The alcohol and drug abuse is so serious that Ringo Starr has no memory of certain events or periods of time. He'll once say, "I was drunk. I didn't notice. Some of those years are absolutely gone. I've got photographs of me playing all over the world, but I've absolutely no memory of it. I played Washington with the Beach Boys, or so they tell me. There's only a photo to prove it." There's a terrible day in 1988 where Ringo gets a horrible wake-up call that makes him realize that he's got to change his life. This is his recounting of the incident. "I came home one Friday afternoon and was told by the staff that I had trashed the house so badly they thought there had been burglars, and I had trashed Barbara so badly they thought she was dead."
Oh, God.
Terrible.
Yeah.
Fortunately, this is the turning point. Both Ringo and Barbara go to 6 weeks in rehab and have never returned to their drug and alcohol abuse. Ringo is now a teetotaler, prides himself on his clean eating, his sober lifestyle. During this time, he'll also ditch his, "This just makes my lungs hurt," his 60 cigarette a day habit.
Wow.
It's 3 packs a day.
Yeah, it's, wow.
He will even find
when did
God.
He have time to drink?
Between 60 cigarettes a day? I don't know. He'll even find God at this time. Ringo and Barbara do not have any children together, but the two of them are still married.
Wow.
And in this month, April 2022, they are celebrating their 41st wedding anniversary.
Good for them.
Terrible redemption arc.
Sure.
In 1998, Ringo Starr will tell an interviewer, "With God's help, I have not had a drink in 9.5 years. That's my whole story right there. And because of that, I'm doing this. I'm making records. I'm touring. I was so involved in just getting brain damaged. I wasn't doing anything. I had great ideas, many notebooks filled with notes. Some of them I can read and some of them I just can't read. But I really didn't do anything constructive. It was all just good ideas. Now I'm trying to lead a constructive life a day at a time.
Good stuff there, Ringo.
In 2021, Ringo Starr will present Billie Eilish with Record of the Year at the Grammys. But before presenting Eilish with the Grammy, he will address all of the nominees and say, if you're making music in our world today, you've already won. And I thank you.
Yeah, and he was born in 1940. Does that mean he's 82? 81, 82? Yes. Wow.
Yeah. Do you have a little bit of a follow-up about Maureen post-divorce?
I was hoping.
Maureen will move in with Hard Rock Cafe and House of Blues founder Isaac Tigret in 1976. They welcome a daughter together in January 1987. And Maureen and Isaac will wait several years to marry, but they do eventually make it official. They get married in Monaco, May 27th, 1989. In the meantime, Ringo and Maureen have become grandparents in 1985, when their eldest son, Zach, and his wife have a daughter. But in 1987, Maureen is going to sue the law firm that handles her divorce from Ringo for an alleged breach of contract and negligence.
Interesting.
She claimed that the firm had not fully investigated Ringo Starr's finances at the time of the divorce and had not given her a proper settlement.
The numbers did seem low, even when you like adjust to pounds and time travel.
It doesn't work out for her, though.
Okay.
The court will find in favor of the law firm and say that Starr was a generous man. Why is this? He increases her yearly payments 2 times since their divorce. The judge further orders Maureen to pay the whole bill for the case. So not only does she lose, but she has to fork out £200,000 for the court bill.
I mean, it's there are arguments.
Rough justice.
There are arguments for that system. It does discourage frivolity.
In 1994, at the opening of House of Blues, Maureen suddenly faints. And at first it's thought that she's merely suffering from anemia. But soon she is diagnosed with a form of leukemia. Maureen undergoes every treatment available. But sadly, on December 30th, 1994, Maureen Starkey Tigret dies at the young age of 48.
Oh, that's so sad.
Her husband, her 4 children, her ex-husband Ringo Starr are all at her bedside when she dies. Following her death, Paul McCartney will write a song called Little Willow in her memory, which appears on his 1997 album Flaming Pie. It has a dedication to her children. It's really a very touching, touching song. Bend, little willow, wind's gonna blow you hard and cold tonight. Life as it happens. Nobody warns you. Willow, hold on tight. That is the trashy divorce of Ringo and Maureen.
I did not realize that he dealt with substance misuse so heavily.
Significant, significant substance misuse, which is good on him. I mean, he's had a completely different life since getting clean.
Sure. I really can't imagine how deforming it must be to be a member of the Beatles in your 20s. Like, it.
Too much.
The rest of your life is just
mind-blowing. Yeah.
So, good story.
As trash cans go.
Went places.
I know. It really was. I told you it was going to be
a little. Got a little tear there at the
end. It's a great story. It turns horrible. It turns kind of greatish at the end. It gets a little bit better as we get back to the end.
Sure.
As trash cans go, I don't know. I mean, Maureen, maybe don't sleep with George Harrison. Maybe George Harrison, don't tell your bandmate about it in front of your wife.
My God.
You know.
It's a lot.
It seems like a lot of problems for the staff. There's certain trash cans. Maybe they're all on Abbey Road and filled with apples. I don't know, from Apple Studios. Unclear on that. It's all a little murky, but it could just be the drugs
maybe
and
like,
all the cigarette haze that move through.
Yeah, maybe like it's fewer trash cans than she would have had with better lawyers. Who knows?
That is the last of the Beatles for trashy divorces.
Mm-hmm.
Been waiting on that one for a long time. When we come back from a quick break, we're going to shoot the arrow.
We are launching some arrows at you.
Over to your side.
Yeah.
See you on the flip.
Sibling fights are unavoidable, but what if every fight you had was under a microscope on a global scale? That's the reality for brothers Prince William and Prince Harry. They were each other's closest friends and allies since the death of their mother, but that all began to crack as they married and took wildly different approaches to their royal duties.
Wondery's podcast, Dis and Tell, is hosted by comedians Sydney Battle and Matt Bellassai. Each episode unpacks one of pop culture's most iconic celebrity feuds, and they recently took a deeper look into the real reason William versus Harry started.
It's actually much bigger than these two brothers, stretching back into the history of the British monarchy. Did their feud start with the royal family's mistreatment of Meghan Markle, or was it something that started much earlier?
Follow Dis and Tell on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, Trash Pandas, Stacy here to share my latest take a mental breather from your day find, Two Dots. Two Dots is a free-to-download puzzle-based mobile game where you connect dots in relaxing puzzles while unlocking levels and collecting treasure and prizes along the way. Connect at least two adjacent dots of the same color to make a move, and remember, dots can connect horizontally and vertically, but never, ever diagonally. And as engaging as the main puzzles are, there are also side quest game modes like the scavenger hunt, where you find hidden objects amidst riotously colorful art, and classic adventure game vibes in the arcade. Each fun and relaxing Two Dots puzzle offers a new gameplay experience, plus the chance to collect trophies, medals, and other souvenirs of your adventures. As you advance through the levels, you'll earn various power-ups and special dots with new effects, like erasing all dots of a certain color or clearing a row and column simultaneously, and the colorful visuals find the perfect balance between stimulating and soothing.
Two Dots is free to download, and you can play even when you're offline. Make it a party by challenging your friends on Facebook. If you're ready to kick back and unwind, download Two Dots for free on Android and iOS and start connecting.
Ladies and gentlemen.
What are you doing?
What do you mean?
Keep it simple.
I'm making the promo.
Just keep it simple. Just say, hey, we're the Brav Bros, two guys that talk about Bravo.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, we're the Brav Bros.
No.
Oh.
Dude, stop with the voice. Just keep it simple.
I've seen promos on TV, dude. This is how you get the fans engaged. This is how you get listeners. We're trying to get listeners here. If we just say, oh, we're two dudes that talk about Bravo, people are going to get tired of it already. We need some oomph.
All right, then fine. Let's try to do it with your voice.
Brav Bros.
Good job.
Lauren, we are sisters.
That's true.
And we host a celebrity-obsessed podcast called Pop Apologists.
We also love Taylor Swift. Chandler, how are you managing to cope while we await Taylor's new album?
Look, I want to be put into a medically induced coma and wake up on April 19th, but I'm not sure my insurance is going to cover it.
Join us on our pop culture podcast, Pop Apologists, where we will be dishing on all things celebrity news and deep diving every word and note of Taylor's new album.
Pop Apologists.
Pop Apologists.
If you have been thinking about your financial situation,
if you've been brewing questions you would like to ask a financial professional,
if you would like some guidance on addressing debt, investing, or other general financial organization,
then in the immortal lyrics of Amy Ray,
I said it's time. Don't assume anything, just
go to theoaktreegroup.net. There you will find the contact information for three holistic financial planners that have been working together for over 17 years. Kelly, Eileen, and Ellen will tailor a financial strategy for your unique goals and circumstances.
You can also give them a call at 770-319-1700 to schedule your free one-hour consultation. They would never use your years to psych you out.
Again, the phone number is 770-319-1700, and the website is www.theoaktreegroup.net.
Go, go, go! So, Stacey, you're bringing us a story from the Marvel universe today.
Yes, a marvel of a tale, it turns out. So, one story that gets requested quite a bit, in a lot of ways, comes with more questions than answers. First of all, when this couple married, they made no public announcement about it for months. But when they broke up just a couple of months after spilling the beans, all hell kind of broke loose. And now every 18 months or so, it seems like Marvel's Hawkeye, the actor Jeremy Renner, is back in the news addressing allegations made by his ex-wife, Sonny Pacheco.
Welcome to Trashy Divorces,
welcome friend. To Trashy Divorces, friends. The sticking point for them is that they are co-parenting a little girl. But it's worth noting that they split up at the end of 2014, and 7 or 8 years on, seems like a long time to stay embroiled in a court fight with your ex.
Wow, that is a long time.
It's a long time. Let's get into this with the caveat that we do our best to avoid naming celebrities minor children. There are a lot of quotes in here, but I'm going to do my best to sub in like kid, daughter, child, that kind of thing. This kid certainly did not ask to have a famous dad, right? That just happened.
Did you hear about my dad? He's a superhero.
Jeremy Lee Renner was born January 7th, 1971 in Modesto, California.
Oh, Capricorn man.
The eldest child of two young lovers who had married as teenagers. What could go wrong? Weirdly, it went wrong. Marrying very young did not end up creating a union appropriate for who they were as they became real adults. And when Jeremy was 10, they divorced. He's the oldest of... I've seen this two ways. Wikipedia says 7 children, while Details Magazine in 2011 said 5. Anyway, what is not in doubt is that in the year 2011, when Jeremy Renner was 40 years old, he became a big brother for the last time. Presumably his father had remarried.
Still doing the love thing, man. Good on you.
Yeah, so... Yeah, baby brother born when he was 40.
That's a...
Anyway.
Quite an age difference.
So I am going to let Adam Sachs at Details Magazine from 2011 set all this up because unlike a lot of Hollywood stars, Jeremy Renner did not smash onto the scene as a young adult and grow into middle age in the public eye. His road was a lot more interesting. This is Sachs. Renner grew up with a pygmy goat named Sugar. He's the oldest kid with 4 siblings who range in age from 37 years to 4 months. He and his best friend, the actor Christopher Winters, whom he also confusingly refers to as my brother, run a successful side business renovating houses. Sometimes he lives in the houses during construction, often without such bougie comforts as electricity and indoor plumbing. Disciplines he's studied include, but are not limited to, world religion, sociology, criminology, Filipino stick fighting, and Muay Thai martial arts. Previous professions, ski instructor, professional makeup artist. He has taught himself to be unafraid of sharks. He has dined with Colin Powell and has regularly basked in the praise of such luminaries as Sean Penn, but about the only time he's found himself starstruck was when he met Cesar Millan, TV's dog whisperer. He is, by turns, cut the bullshit intense and just fucking with you funny. He's religiously unsentimental, quote, I don't give a shit about the past, and unabashedly devoted to his cream-colored miniature French bulldog, Franklin. These are some of the facts that you may collect in your net while standing in the riptide current that is a casual conversation with Jeremy Renner.
He sounds like a real Renaissance man.
Really does. I love that Adam Sachs piece. All of our sources, as always, are at trashydivorces.com. Jeremy Renner graduated high school in Modesto in 89 and headed to Modesto Junior College. He was filling out his schedule one term and he just picked up drama as an elective. He was studying computer science and criminology, I think were the, not sure what he was intending to go do with that. But in this drama class, the acting bug bit him hard. I mean, it left a welt, a scar. He continues to be scarred. But success did not come easily to him. He spent the 90s in small roles, as you would expect, and to make ends meet, he had a side hustle as a makeup artist at the Lancome counter at a Modesto mall.
Fantastic.
His first notable role was playing serial killer Jeffrey Dahmer in 2002's Dahmer, which did boost his profile, and it earned him a nomination for the Independent Spirit Award for Best Lead Male. I wouldn't say things snowballed from there, but the roles he started to win and the casts he began to join steadily advanced in prominence, I guess would be one way to put it. But again, this was 02. It was not until 2009 in The Hurt Locker that the trajectory of his life and career completely changed. This is a full 20 years after throwing his lot in as an actor and against all odds and just through sheer stick-to-itiveness. His portrayal of a bomb disposal expert during the Iraq War earned him a Best Actor nomination for the Academy Awards and at the Screen Actors Guild. Pretty big deal. Back to that Sachs piece in Details Magazine. There's something compellingly unusual about a guy who's been a working actor for two decades, working but struggling, and then rather suddenly finds himself a leading man with his pick of major franchises. Here he is, jumping off buildings opposite Tom Cruise in Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol. Next, he's leathered up as the arrow-slinging Hawkeye in the Joss Whedon-helmed superhero supergroup The Avengers, alongside Robert Downey Jr., Iron Man, Scarlett Johansson, Black Widow, Chris Hemsworth, Thor, and Samuel L. Jackson, Nick Fury. Then he's out for vengeance in the just-wrapped action comedy Hansel and Gretel, Witch Hunters. Quote, "That was a blast," Renner says. "It's 15 years later, and they're pissed off. They're bounty hunters killing witches for a living."
Interesting.
I know, I need to go check that out. Okay, so this kind of gets us to the modern situation that is Jeremy Renner. He seriously paid his dues, he stuck to it, even as it spawned his extremely successful side enterprise as a house flipper. Like, he flips multi-million dollar properties in the LA area.
Wow.
Another interesting thing about those two decades in relative obscurity is that he never married or, as far as I can tell, had any sort of high-profile bromance. Although when it comes to his personal life, I think high-profile is exactly the opposite of what he's going for. That said, a former acting coach of Jeremy Renner at some point during those struggle years mentioned to a reporter that Jeremy is gay, prompting decades of speculation. He's denied it, always stressing the importance to him of a truly private life, and I think kind of wishing we lived in a world where he could be both a famous actor as well as a normal person, and that is not the world we live in. In any case, suddenly very famous, he was also to meet a woman who would become the mother of his, and hers, of course, I'm not sure why we phrase it that way, child. Briefly his wife, and then an ex-wife that even an experienced vengeance demon would be pretty impressed by at this point in time. And I'm not saying that as a dig. One way of looking at what's happened in the aftermath is that Sonny Pacheco has been vigorously protective and is trying to keep her kids safe from an out-of-control father. But we'll get to that. It was apparently on the set of Mission Impossible Ghost Protocol that Jeremy and Sonny met back in 2010. The relationship led to a baby in 2013, and in 2014, without alerting the media, Jeremy and Sonny walked down the aisle together. Sonny Pacheco is a Canadian-born model about whom there is considerably less biographical material on the internet than her more famous ex-husband. She was probably born in 1991, making her 20 years younger than Jeremy, and may have grown up on a farm in British Columbia. Sounds nice. She came south at a young age. Very, very south, it turns out. Her bio says that she sold timeshares in Mexico for 4 months when she was 19 years old.
Huh.
But she came to the States and resumed or began, not clear, modeling, ending up as a brand ambassador for Monster Energy drinks, and she had a couple bit parts in movies, which I think is how she was with the Ghost Protocol milieu. Apparently, she and Jeremy met when Ghost Protocol was filming in Vancouver, the greatest city in the world. But their relationship was kept private, as noted. In fact, when Jeremy announced that he was becoming a dad, he described the situation as, quote, an ex-girlfriend is pregnant, and had moved in with him and his roommate, house-flipping business partner and fellow actor Christopher Winters.
Huh.
Huh.
It's very interesting.
Indeed.
Go on, go on.
What? Quick timeline here. Their daughter was born March 2013, and on January 13th, 2014, they wed. And on December 30th, 2014, Sonny filed for divorce, citing our old favorite, irreconcilable differences.
1 year tip to toe. Really?
Yeah.
New Year's Day to the end of the year?
No, they married January 13th. They filed for divorce.
December 30th?
Yeah, and it's
all
possible.
All inside of 1 year, that's what
I'm
saying.
It's all inside of 1 year. Okay. December 30th may have just been when the news broke. Like when someone noticed in legal filing, it may have been earlier in December even. It's been described as a 10 and 11 month marriage is how it's often written out. But the baby came like a year earlier. So
that's very fast.
The world didn't find out they had married at all until a September 2014 interview with Capital File.
Oh, right before they announced the divorce?
Yes.
Good timing.
I know, this is so weird. Where in a moment perhaps of fatherly bliss, he spilled the beans. Here's the passage. This is from an interview by Elizabeth E. Thorpe from 2014. She says, tell me about fatherhood. You have a baby daughter. Does she live with you? Are you married to her mother? And his answer is yes, smiling. So Thorpe says, I did not know that. Congratulations. How come nobody knows that? And Renner says, I've tried to protect my family's privacy, my wife's privacy. I don't need her to get hammered with my life. Privacy issues are important because I want her to go about her day without being bothered.
Very nice. Totally makes sense.
Yeah. So Thorpe asks, do you get bothered a lot? And he says, yeah, paparazzi follow me, and that's fine, but it's annoying being followed when I'm with my family. It's not just me. Everyone in Hollywood has to deal with that. I've been talked about a whole lot because the less I put out there, the less people know, and it makes it interesting, I assume. So she goes on to say, how do you think that fatherhood has changed you? And, I mean, he positively gushes about fatherhood, like, anytime it comes up. It's actually very sweet to watch. He says, it's the best thing I've ever done, doing it later on in life. By then, I achieved a lot of things that I wanted to achieve. I'm so blessed for that. Now I can really spend time with the family. The only thing I think about when I'm not with my baby is, how do I get to my baby? I need to get to her, and I'm very miserable when I don't see her. I really love being a father. The only thing that has changed is my perspective on things. I still work, probably even more. It used to be for myself, so I'm not old and broke. All these things I still do, but I do it now for the future of my baby, and if it gets in the way of her well-being, then I stop. So he goes on to say that she's 17 months old, and he thinks it's the greatest age, and he can't wait for her to get older, but she's so much fun now, and that she's into her sticker phase, which is just, anyway.
That's so nice.
It really is nice. Yeah, I think he went on Ellen and talked about how being a dad is the best role he's taken yet. You know, like, he really just lights up when his kid comes up, which is, that's great. This is from a Nikki Swift piece called The Double Life of Jeremy Renner by Andy Scott and Mario Loveland. Incidentally, Jeremy Renner and Sonny Pacheco's brief marriage played out a little like Three's Company. The reason, their home included a roommate, Christopher Winters, whom The Hollywood Reporter described as Renner's, quote, live-in business partner, and whom Renner described as my brother in a 2012 profile. Winters wound up playing a key role in Renner's divorce from Pacheco by providing pretty damning testimony against Renner's now ex-wife. Quote, on approximately 8 additional occasions at our Franklin Avenue home, Sonny told me that she did not believe in marriage and only wanted Jeremy to marry her so she could become a United States citizen and avoid returning to Canada.
Oh.
Winters said, according to court documents. Quote, I heard Sonny say at least 5 or 6 times when we were together at the Franklin house, that Jeremy should be nice to her and not fight her on green card or money issues, or else she would release intimate videos of him to TMZ. Winters also alleged that he saw Pacheco regularly smoke cigarettes and drink alcohol while pregnant. Pacheco obviously has denied the substance use claims, but Nikki Swift writers note that she did not address his extortion claim, so that's interesting. Sonny, meanwhile, alleged that Jeremy had stolen a number of her important documents, including her passport, her birth certificate, her Social Security card, and she wanted the court to make him hand them over and, quote, be restrained from making further efforts to conceal same. There was a prenup in place, but she asked that it be invalidated, you know, after 10 months due to fraud, but sadly for us, she did not choose to expand on what fraud might mean in this context in the filing, so more the pity on that. Sonny also expressed concerns about their daughter's safety, alleging that Jeremy has an extensive gun collection that is not always housed in a gun safe, and that a pool and pond on his property weren't fenced, which would pose a drowning hazard for their then, like, almost 2-year-old. These are fully reasonable. Like, that yes.
Makes a lot of sense.
Firearms in a gun safe and, yeah, keep the, like, some barrier to keep the kid away from water. Like, got it. I think this was worked out. And the reason I think this was worked out, they managed to hammer out a settlement agreement in the first half of 2015, which is kind of light speed as these things go. And People magazine reported that they had joint legal and physical custody of their child, with Jeremy paying $13,000 a month in child support, zero in spousal support. All good, right? Well, no. Because 13 months later, Sonny headed back to court to allege that Jeremy was almost $50,000 behind on child support And further, he was refusing to pay his half of their then three-year-old $1,600 a month preschool costs. His lawyers fired back that he had paid several hundreds of thousands of dollars in support that year alone, was not behind, and that the divorce decree did not require him to pay part of the preschool costs.
Yeah, $13,000 a month is $156,000 a year, if my math is correct. It's pretty significant.
For a two-ish year old.
Yeah.
It's... This dust-up ended early in the fall of 2016 when Jeremy agreed to give Sunny $16,000, like much less than the $50,000 that she was saying. $16,000 in support plus, and here's a kicker, $24,000 to pay off her lawyers and accountants who had, of course, brought this matter before the court. That is a bad incentive structure. I understand why it exists, but that's a bad incentive structure. Let's jump ahead something like a year and a half to April of 2018, when Sunny again headed back to court, pointing out that Jeremy's Marvel salary, $11.4 million that year, made their old agreement moot. Now, this is a feature of extremely high-dollar divorces that I feel a little queasy about. Typically, child support is calculated as a percentage of the higher-earning parent's income. Non-custodial higher-earning, I guess. It's complicated, but in any case, this makes sense. But what percentage of $11.4 million does a five-year-old kid need to thrive?
It's a question.
Walk me through this. Like, it just seems like the formula should not necessarily apply. Like, the agreement they came to was that he would fork over an additional $292,000 in child support that year. But for the years 2018, 2019, and 2020, any amount over $200,000 would go into an education savings account for their daughter. And if upon completing her education, there was money left over in that account, it would be held in trust until she turned 27.
All of this is very smart.
Right. This is, there
are... I want to make sure you don't get my largesse.
Exactly.
It goes to the kid.
Right. We agreed on zero spousal support.
Right.
So this is not your money. This is her money. But then, twists and turns. This is like a superhero story almost. Okay. Word of a super disturbing November 2018 incident came out, which has shaped a lot of the contours of the ongoing on and off custody disputes. In Touch Weekly had the story as told by former Jeremy friend, the artist Lily Faget. According to her, she took a very inebriated Jeremy home after they'd hung out with a group of friends at an LA bar, and she walked him in to make sure he got in okay. Then, and this is where the story begins, he got into the safe, took a gun out, cocked it, Faget recalls. It was loaded, which I wasn't even sure of at the time. He was waving it around, gesticulating. I was standing really close to him, but for some reason I didn't run away. I was really worried. He gestured around when he was talking and put it in his mouth and threatened to end his life.
No.
Faget says she realized that Jeremy's daughter was home, young child daughter was home, when her nanny confronted the actor, and he allegedly shot his gun into the ceiling after the altercation. I just stood there, Faget says. I didn't run, which was weird. You don't really know how to act in that scenario. He still had the gun in his hand, and I was scared. He said, "No one is taking me seriously." I said, "I'm taking you very seriously. Please put the gun down." He put the gun down, and I was panicked. Faget says the last time she communicated with Renner was after he filed a declaration in court about the 2018 shooting incident. In it, he claimed Faget was under the influence that night and denied most of her version of the incident.
Huh, interesting.
Mm-hmm. She believes Renner continues to get away with his dangerous lifestyle because he surrounds himself with people who enable him and are enamored with his fame. So she herself has gone into therapy and hopes that one day her now former friend Jeremy will as well. So that's got to be the worst of it, right? Like gunplay, shots fired in the house. With a, The following fall, Sunny asked for full custody and the Jeremy's visits with their daughter be supervised because, she claimed, that while he was drunk and high on cocaine at an LA nightclub, he told someone he, quote, could not deal with Sunny anymore and he just wanted her gone.
Oh, no.
And that the nanny overheard him saying that he would drive to Sunny's house and kill her and then kill himself because, quote, it was better that their daughter had no parents than to have Sunny as a mother.
Oh, no, 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 no.
She also said he had left cocaine on a bathroom counter where the girl could find it. Not that she did, like, she wasn't alleging that the girl did find it, just that it could have been found there. Jeremy responded with basically the same ask. This was almost mocking her, which seems, I don't know. So he, no, judge, actually, I would like full custody and supervised visits only for my ex-wife over there. And he further alleged that she had sent nude photos of him to their custody evaluator to embarrass him. By this point, Sonny had transitioned out of modeling and had begun a career as a sculptor. So Jeremy complained that her work was far too explicit and that their daughter shouldn't be exposed to, quote, such dark, graphic, sexual material on a daily basis. I don't think he cared, but...
You gotta counter with something.
Yeah. Next, Sonny said that Jeremy had bitten their child while angry. This is still October 2019, by the way. Which he denied, saying that her seatbelt had pinched her and it was, like, nothing. Things only got more complicated when the coronavirus swept in 2020. With his projects on hold for the foreseeable future, he headed to court, for once, asking that his child support payments be reduced from $30,000 a month, reported, to a mere $11,000 a month. The child was six at this point, 6 years old. Sonny insisted in a press statement that no how, no way did she receive $30,000 a month in child support, and that all of her and her daughter's savings had been siphoned by lawyers in the endless battle against her ex on behalf of the child's safety. It is classic divorce stuff.
Games people play.
This. I don't even know who's playing the games. There's such a power imbalance between these two people. I really don't know. You know, Jeremy said that she was misusing their daughter's money. She said that she was using the money for their daughter. She asked a court to impose mandatory drug tests on Jeremy. The court declined to do that. In November of 2021, Jeremy told Men's Health that he tries to just not respond, not fuel fires of what he described as, and I quote, nonsense. Sonny, meanwhile, describes events more as like a long season in hell, with a 2020 statement noting, I am sick of being continually bullied, having my name slandered, and the truth muted. Anyone who is a parent knows that the most important thing in the world is their child's health and safety. Over the years, it's hard to fathom what I've seen and what people have told me they've seen in regards to Jeremy's disturbing actions while our child is in his care. Friends, I have no idea where the truth lies in all of these allegations. My biggest thought really is just how exhausting it must be to live in this much conflict for years at a time. It is worth noting that the judge or judges involved in the case have not hindered anyone's custody in this, like, screaming, this ongoing screaming match. Judges have not been persuaded that either parent is a risk of hurting the child, which is great. It is worth considering, though, Jeremy Renner has Marvel Studios behind him, right? Like, if what she's saying is true, they're very powerful people in the powerful industry there to possibly protect him. And if what she's saying is false, that just sucks for him to just get hit with news stories like this all the time. Like, divorced people, man. Child custody.
That's quite a battle.
It is. And I suspect it's going to continue until the child turns 18 or whatever. I don't think this is the last we're going to hear of this. I do hope everybody can find their peace with the situation. I don't know what's happened. I don't know how many trash cans to award. A Marvel Studios full.
Less than a year of them.
Yeah. Yes, 10 months of trash cans.
Well done.
Thanks.
That's pretty terrible.
It was requested. It's tough. I don't...
We hope you're happy, Amy.
Yeah.
Thanks for bringing that one to us as we close out this week of Trashy Divorces, Stacey. Holy cats, thanks everybody for tuning in and listening this week. If you need more Trashy Divorces in the meantime, you can check us out at patreon.com/trashydivorces. Don't forget, if you're into old Hollywood Laurel Canyon, now is definitely the week to tune into my other little podcast, Done and Done. You'll have some happy listening over there.
We'll be back on Wednesday with an all-new Trashy Breakups. And until then, friends,
keep your hands clean.
Keep your hearts trashy.
Thanks for tuning in. Big love, everybody. Have a terrific week.
Bye.
Bye. And thanks to you for listening. Trashy Divorces is a Hemlock Creatives production, created and produced right here in Atlanta, Georgia, by us, Stacy and Alicia, with a little research and writing help from the brilliant Melissa O.
Our art is by Sydney V. Smith. That's Sydney V. Smith at carbonmade.com. And our music is used with permission of Ratsy. Check her out at Ratsy's store on Instagram, and definitely drop into Ratsy's store anytime you're in Oberlin, Ohio.
You can contact us at trashydivorces@gmail.com or find us on the World Wide Web at trashydivorces.com.
If you need more trash candy in your life, our Patreon community includes some of the very best humans around and thousands of hours of bonus content at every level of support. Join the fun at patreon.com/trashydivorces.
Interested in some Trashy Divorces swag? Check out our merch shop and Trash Panda Enthusiasm Society at bit.ly/trashygear.
Want to advertise with us? Reach out to sales@advertisecast.com for more information.
And last but not least, come play with us on social media. I keep most of our Trashy Divorces Instagram hopping. Stacy and I share it up over on Facebook, including our Trashy Divorces podcast discussion group. Come join us over there, and thanks again, everybody, for listening.
Keep it trashy, y'all.